Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it is such a pleasure to be here with all of you on this beautiful fall afternoon. I'm so excited about today and about our speaker. If you wouldn't mind just taking a moment to turn off your cell phones, today's program will be recorded for the radio, and you can access to listen to this program as well as all of our previous programs either through our website or directly at Alaska Public Media at their website, alaskapublic.org. And I'd like to thank Kari Gardy for doing the recording for Alaska Public Media today. We are a membership organization, and you might have seen either in the mail or on your table a new promotional opportunity we have thanks to the Atwood Foundation. It's called a golden ticket, and the Atwood Foundation has generously offered to match any membership of $1,000 or more to the World Affairs Council, dollar for dollar, up to $20,000. So we can have 20 such golden tickets, and we currently have 5. So we highly encourage you to help us take advantage of this matching opportunity. And as an extra incentive, the Alaska World Affairs Council will give you free admission to all of our programs this upcoming year. You can also see a flyer on your table, and you'll see what we have to offer. That's a $500 value, so please take advantage of this opportunity and consider joining us and thanking the Atwood Foundation for this opportunity. We also this year have an anonymous donor who has sponsored 8 military personnel, and we are thrilled to see so many of their faces today, and we welcome you wholeheartedly to our program. And if you're a student, we have some wonderful students today. Would you mind standing? I'm so excited to see so many faces of our students. Thank you so much for coming. I want to thank BP for sponsoring our student program, allowing students to come to all of our programs for the whole year. And we have some outstanding teachers who are bringing their students. I know today we have a group from ROTC at South High School. We have some students from Central Middle School. We have Wonder Park Elementary School with the wonderful Sean Murphy. And I understand that the Central Middle School folks in preparation had a lesson in place settings and what to do in the sort of business setting. And that's the sort of thing that we are just really excited about, the learning opportunity for students to be able to come to our programs and get the experience on so many different levels. And speaking of students, I really want to thank our speaker who went above and beyond. As you know, we always invite our speakers to go to a local school before they come here. And about 8 or 9 out of 10 times they say yes, they would do that. Well, our speaker today said, I will go and see as many as I can. So I picked him up at 8 o'clock this morning and have been running him around. He's talked to 100 students. We start at McLaughlin Youth Center this morning to 40 captive students, no pun intended on that one, who are super excited that he has arrest warrants out for his arrest from both ISIS and President Assad, and had quite the conversation. It was a really powerful discussion. And we also went to West High School, where we overpacked the room. People were sitting on the floor trying to get space to listen to him speak today. And we also today have our superintendent of schools, Mr. Ed Graff. Thank you so much for your support for all that you do. And you can also see at our head table at my far left is Tam Auguste Giesler, who's on the school board. You might know her as the former director of the School Business Partnership. We know her as a former board member of the World Affairs Council, and through all those hats, she has been supporting what the students do with the World Affairs Council and things for students around the community. We really appreciate all the work she has done and our partnership with the School Business Partnership. If you're new to the World Affairs Council, like I said, we have programs on your table that talk about our upcoming program series, which we are just really excited about. Our next program will be here at the Hilton on October 3rd, where we will be featuring Dr. Ronald Taman, who will be talking about, will China rule the world? So if that's an interesting question, please join us on the 3rd of October. And with that, I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Ms. Tam Auguste Giesler, as I previously mentioned. And to her right, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Chuck Colson, the chairman of our board of directors, who makes my job wonderful every day. Chuck.
Thank you, Lisa, and good afternoon. It's my great pleasure today to welcome Dr. Radwan Ziadeh to speak to us today. Dr. Ziadeh is the founder and director of the Damascus Center of Human Rights Studies in Syria and co-founder and executive director of the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. He's the managing editor of the Transitional Justice in the Arab World Project. He is also a member of the Syrian National Preparatory Committee for Transitional Justice. Since the Syrian uprising started in March 15, 2011, he was involved in documenting the ongoing human rights violations in Syria and testified at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva twice. He was also involved in the Syrian political opposition. He was elected in October 2011 as director of the Foreign Relations Office of the Syrian National Council until he resigned from that position in November of 2012. Dr. Ziadeh was also editor-in-chief of Tiarat magazine in 2001 and 2002 and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. He was a researcher with the UNDP's Syria 2025 project and was named best political scientist researcher in the Arab world by Jordan's Abdulhamid Shoman Foundation in 2004. In 2009, he was awarded the Middle East Studies Association Academic Freedom Award in Boston, and in 2010, he accepted the Democracy Courage Tributes Award on behalf of the human rights movement in Syria, given by the World Movement for Democracy in Jakarta. Dr. Ziadeh was one of the major players in the Damascus Spring, a period of intense debate about politics, social issues, and calls for reform in Syria after the death of President Hafez al-Assad in 2000. His most recent book is Power and Policy in Syria, Intelligence Services, Foreign Relations, and Democracy in the Modern Middle East. You can find a list of his other books on our website. He is a frequent political commentator on several U.S., European, and Middle Eastern media outlets, such as Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, BBC, and Al Hura. He also writes a bi-monthly op-ed for the leading Arab daily Al Hayat. Dr. Ziadeh is here today to speak to us on Syria, from struggle for freedom to humanitarian crisis. Please join me in welcoming him to the podium.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to thank the Alaska World Affairs Council for the invitation and for such wonderful opportunity to come here to Alaska. This is my first visit here. I enjoyed Anchorage, Juneau, and I got inspired by actually a lot of activities and work, especially with the visit to the students' school today. My talk here will focus on what's going on in Syria. I'm sure that most of you heard Syria, at least from the news, because too much talking on the news about this country, and of course much more focus on the U.S. involvement on Syria after the United States decided to target some of the groups, Al-Qaeda affiliated group in Syria called ISIS. But before, we have to understand the roots of the problems in Syria and why the United States decided now to take actions not 2 or 3 years before, and what's the consequences and the reflections of that. Since in 2000, I left Syria in 2007. I came to the United States. Most of my research and study was focused on the issue of transitional justice. Transitional justice is a concept which some of the countries who actually witnesses a mass or gross human rights violations, war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity in a way to build a legitimacy of the legal institutions, of the state institutions. This concept has been adopted most of the African countries, Latin America, and some of the Asian. And it has differed. And this is why required a lot of research and visit to many of the countries. When the Syrian uprising started on March 2011, I thought that I should focus much of my study and research on Syria. This is why we started documenting the human rights violations committed by the Assad government at the beginning of the uprising. The Syrian uprising was a consequence of what we call the Arab Spring, which started in Tunisia in December 2010, then in Egypt, Yemen, Libya, then in Syria. Most or those five countries, they share the same similarities regarding the state institutions, regarding the dictatorship, very repressive regimes, the basic rights never been respected. It's very normal for any political prisoners die under torture in the security branches. There is no freedom of expression or freedom of press. This is why it was very easy when Tunisian young or the youth and students universities rose against the dictatorship of Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, very inspired by the youth in Egypt, then in Yemen, and in Syria. We'll see here in the picture, this is in the city of Homs, with thousands of female activists rising against the Assad government in 2011. Of course, the response of those governments to the inspiration of the people was different. In Egypt, the revolution lasted only 31 days, then it was negotiations, and now led to the peaceful transition. They draft new constitutions. But in Syria and in Libya was a different case, where the regimes, they decided actually to shoot the people and kill the activists who lead these peaceful demonstrations. And this is where my organization and my work start to focus on these issues. It's always in the news, on the media, we compare Syria to different countries. Because this is one of my visit was to Bosnia, and this is the main cemetery in Sarajevo. After the Srebrenica massacre, which more than 8,000 has been killed by the Serbians' troop, and the former President Clinton, who actually helped the Bosnian at that time, he opened this cemetery, his cemetery, as commemoration for the international community to remember the needs of to take actions, not to such massacre or war crimes, and the Bosnian, they call it the genocide, not to repeat it again. And this is maybe in the news, you heard that President Clinton twice, he mentioned that we should take actions in Syria, not to have what happened, because he believed that it was his guilty, that he did not take actions in Bosnia, which led to the Srebrenica massacre in Sarajevo. But when I studied all of that, I never thought that what happened in Rwanda or in Bosnia will happen again in my home country, in Syria or in my hometown. This is actually a picture of the massacre happened in my hometown in Daraya. I'm born in a city called Daraya, which is 7 kilometers south of Damascus. The population of my hometown, it's 250,000. Only 5,000 left in the city. All of them now has become as refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. My mother, she lives now in Turkey. My sister in Jordan, other sister in Lebanon. And this is the case of every single family in Syria right now, because according to the UN, Syria has at least 4 million refugees in the neighboring countries, and they have 6 million displaced inside the country. And this is when the massacre carried out in Daraya, it was on August 23rd, 2011, and the guy in the blue shirt, this is my cousin. It was very difficult to see, actually, this is his picture, this is his family, kids. And even that they don't have, the government did not allow them to bury all of these bodies in dignity. This is one of the mass graves in the city, because the government, they destroy the cemetery. This is the cemetery in the town, which the government destroyed. The question, how, what's the response of the international community? This is the statements by the Secretary General of the UN about the massacre in Daraya. He called it for investigations, but there is no actions being taken, or there is no investigation even taken on the issue. We thought it's in 1994, when the genocide in Rwanda happened, where actually the Hutu government slaughtered more than 1 million from Tutsis. And then later on in 1995, when the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, the international community was thinking about ways to prevent these war crimes and crimes against humanity to be repeated. And this is why the concept never again came from. And we thought at that time, because we don't have many pictures of what's happening in Rwanda, in Syria, different case. We have at least 1 million and a half YouTubes document the crimes and war crimes. And we thought that the revolution in the social media will generate reaction from the international community different than the one in Rwanda and in Bosnia. We'll see. No, it wasn't any action. But more of that, we'll see in this picture, those actually the Assad officers who committed the massacre in the city, they are celebrating. And they posting their photos and in their profiles in the Facebook page. Would that lead us to the question that how the international community was not failing to prevent these massacres rather than actually put an accountability or to end the culture of the impunity. This is the city of Daraya, one of the demonstrations, how they rising up with the flowers peacefully. And this is one of the leaders who the Washington Post called him as a Gandhi of Syria, because he invented the idea of having a battle and flowers. And this is actually what's Daraya now. This is my building, my supposed to be my hometown. And this is, of course, you'll see the destruction. This is the main street in the city. And then back in after Rwanda genocide and the massacres in Bosnia, the international community tried to build different system, build the International Criminal Court, started in effect in 2007, and then build what's called the responsibility to protect, which a concept within the UN, adopted by the UN, that's the responsibility of the international community to prevent the dictators or the repressive regimes from committing massacres or war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide against its own people. And also enable to the weak states from other non-state actors to come and to make any massacres or war crimes. But Syria is telling us a different story, because the division within the Security Council, Russia and China, who's been supported the Assad government, they vetoed three resolutions, doesn't allow the UN to take any actions to help the Syrian people. The destruction wasn't in one hour. This is the city of Aleppo. Aleppo, according to the UNESCO, the UN, it's the oldest inhabited city in the world. And this is, you will see in the photos, how the destruction in the city. This is one of the oldest mosques. This is the church, one of the oldest churches. Why is that? Why such destruction? And the UN actually estimate the number of people, of the casualties in Syria, is 200,000 because of the extensive use of the air power from the Assad government. This is why the first demand of the Syrian people in 2012 that the international community or the US, they should impose the no-fly zone to prevent the Assad government from the use of the air power, which actually led to thousands of casualties. And of course, the use of the long-range missiles, we call in the Scud missiles. This is actually type of the Soviet Union that they give it to the Assad government in the 90s. And the UN, the US consider the Scud missiles as a mass of destruction weapons, because it can carry out nuclear bombs and chemical weapons. This is a photo I take when I visited Aleppo. You will see that the destruction, those three buildings, has been destroyed totally by the use of the long-range missiles, the Scud. The United States provide Israel and Turkey with a defense system called Patriot. The Patriot system, which can challenge those long-range missiles in the air, which prevent them actually from reaching its target. But they don't provide the Syrian people of any of these. This is why the Syrian, they developed a system. Do you know what's the system? It's a Facebook page. Because this long-range missiles, it's been always launched from the south of Syria. It needs 15 minutes to reach its destination in the north. This is why the activists, they make a Facebook page. And when the Assad forces, they launch one of those missiles, they post it on the Facebook that's the time and the minute and the second. And this is why the people in the north, they have 15 minutes to escape or to run. And of course, there is no chance. And this is why the number of people been killed by those, the Scots, are thousands of thousands. And the UN itself confirmed the use of 92 long-range missiles by the Assad government. And then we ended up exactly like these cartoons, that everyone calling condemned the Assad use, and he's continued killing his own people. Then the President Obama came and he said, you have a red line. You should not use the chemical weapons against its own people. You can do whatever by conventional weapons, but don't use the chemical weapons. This is a red line. But the Assad crossed the red line and he used the chemical weapons in 21st of August 2013, which led more than 1,400 to be killed in Eastern Ghouta, and among them 426 children. It was actually in the same way that the UN is confirmed by the US of the chemical attacks against the Syrian. And the area at that time, it was still until today we are speaking now, it's under siege. There is no doctors, even the Assad government did not allow for any equipment and to help. And for the Syrians who's never been actually educated about how they deal with such chemical attacks, because if when you have a chemical attacks, you should go up. Because they usually, when they heard actually the rockets being launched by seven different rockets, everyone goes to the basement, where the basement, according to the UN, the sarin gas has been used, was one of the thickest gas in the world. This is why you will see families. I met a family, one, and we bring him to the UN to testify. He lost 41 members of his families. Because that's everyone go to the basements, and this is large number of victims of the use. And of course, mostly died because of the sarin gas. This was an opportunity for the President Obama to take actions to help the Syrian people. But then a mysterious deal happened between the Assad and the Russians to give up his chemical weapons, and then the U.S. will not strike the Assad government. Then after a year, nothing changed. The Assad government continue using the air power against the Syrian people. We'll see actually using the barrel bombs. Since the chemical deal until today, more than 76,000 been killed by the use of the air force. We'll see actually the children, babies, the destruction. And of course, the extensive use of the air force and the bombarding create the international crisis of the Syrian refugees. It's not a year ago, this is 3 days ago. You have 70,000 of Syrian Kurds who on the Turkish border, who the Turkish government did not allow them to go through because they have enough Syrian refugees. Of course, today they confirmed that in the last 3 days they have 130,000 of the Syrian refugees. And this is the same case in Lebanon or Jordan. With such a vacuum, that's allowed for some terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda linked group or ISIS. I get different emails and phone calls from the journalists because the ISIS, they get different names. The ISIS, ISIL, IS, or Daesh. Those different names for the same organization. But that depends on how we do the translation. ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. ISIL, if we translated Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And now this organization dropped Iraq and Syria and they called themselves Islamic State. This is why we call them IS. It's the same organizations. It's one of the most terror organizations linked to Al-Qaeda and other groups. It was actually a replacement of and you will see here two-thirds of the leaders, aide or advisors, are Iraqi army officers who served in the Iraqi army during the Saddam Hussein. This is why the government of Iraq, and they use the sectarian term, which allowed that the Sunni community in Iraq, they've been supported of ISIS. But in Syria, it's a different story because ISIS, they committed crimes against the Syrian population. This is why the armed opposition, they fight against ISIS. Since January 2014 until September, the Syrian opposition lost more than 3,300 in the fight against the opposition. And now the United States decided to take actions against the ISIS itself, not against the Assad government. They said, we will not ally ourselves with a mass murder or with a person who gassed his own people to stay in power. but also will not target him. Will only target the ISIS groups inside Syria. Then how the situation ended up in Syria? The ISIS, it's only been exactly like what former Secretary Clinton said, that the failure to help the Syrian rebels led to the rise of ISIS. I mean, because now President Obama adopted resolution to arm the Syrian opposition, which been actually on the table 2 years and a half before. If the United States take actions before, that will not find ourselves in such a position right now. And this is why it's now it became a very fun story, because the Syrian, they don't know the bombarding coming from. In the day, you have the Assad air forces bombarding different cities in Syria. And in night, you have the US Air Force striking the ISIS targets inside Syria. Then in day, you have the Assad government. In night, you have the US government. No matter if you've been killed by the US or by the Syrian forces, you're killed. And this is why I think the US have to think again about their proposal and to start target the Assad government, at least to impose the no-fly zone to prevent the Assad government from the use the air forces against the Syrian population. Because the people has been stuck between the strikes in day and night, and no, they don't know exactly who's this and who's striking, who's doing what. And some of the strikes attack the civilians by the Assad air forces, but because this is what the population, they say this is US flights. And this is why the suffering of the Syrian people continue with this. I say it should the US target the ISIS, but with the same, they should include targets of the Assad government or in both the no-fly zone. This is why some of the regional countries, like Turkey, Qatar, and the Saudis, they insist that with the same time, we should target the ISIS, we should target also the Assad government, because we don't want to be seen among the Syrian people that we are don't care about the killings of the civilians by Assad government, which we only target the ISIS. Then the question happened, who's replaced the Assad, or who will fill the vacuum? This is why my organizations developed a program for the last year we called Syria Transition Roadmap. It's a different groups of the Syrian opposition, a group of political reform, a group of constitutional reform, a group of political parties, a group of election, and a group of transitional justice and national reconciliation, and a group of economic reform. The findings and recommendations of these different working groups, they made the Syria Transition Roadmap, who's been adopted by the main opposition groups and supported by all wide spectrum of the Syrian opposition. And I have some CDs, you can take one at the table there. This is a recommendations which can put recommendations of the future, how the Syrian opposition will be able actually to pass the transition and to end the suffering and the crisis. It first required the support of the international community and the US to get rid of the Assad government and to be able the transition to start. As the US did in Iraq very rightly, they put pressure on the Maliki government to change the Maliki to have inclusive government, to allow for the Sunni to see that they have at least a say in their government, the same in Syria. You will not win your war by only targeting, striking individuals, rather than actually getting the Syrian people in your side by opening the political transition, with the same time helping the people to end this ongoing sufferings. Thank you very much.
Dr. Ziadeh has agreed to take a few questions. Reminder that we are recording this for later rebroadcast, so please wait until a microphone gets to you before you ask your question.
Thank you very much, Doctor. That was very informative. But in none of this, there was no mention of the role of Russia. Could you explain to us a little bit about what Russia's role in Syria is and the influence that Russia has in Syria?
Yes, thank you. It's the Russia has different interests in Syria. I mean, the Assad government is the only lasting regime in the Middle East who still have strong relationship with Russia. This is why for them actually protecting the Assad is really important. Then Russian, they see what's happened in other nations in the Arab Spring, which became all of them much more closer to the West rather than to Russia. This is why they don't see actually a new leadership in Syria emerging which believe in good partnership with the U.S., partnership with the West. This is for them is a red line. The third thing, they have actually military base with the in the city in coastal called Tartus. Well, this is the only military base in the whole Mediterranean Sea. This is why they need reserve it, and they have agreement with the Assad government regarding that. This is regarding the special interest, but beyond that, the Russians, or under the Putin leadership, they still lived in the Cold War era. For them, it's really important to be recognized as the international players. This is why in the Geneva conference, which being co-hosted by the US and Russia in February 2014, it was very important for them, as they told me, to set Secretary John Kerry along with the same table with with Lavrov, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, where actually the Europeans, the French, the British, and others sitting on the tables. That's very important because that's recognized their international role. And this is why they found their leverage with the Assad government. But I can see this is a very short term, very short term. But no matter the days, the Assad will go. I don't think that the Syrian will accept any way of the Assad staying in power. Then I think in every government will replace the Assad, will put the relationship with Russia in question.
Thank you very much for your comments and that your response about Russia. I wanted to ask you about the role of Western European nations. You've made a lot of comments about what the U.S. should do, and you're in the United States, so it's worth trying to get that point across. But what about Western European nations, and what role do you see for them, and the reluctance of them to be engaged in the way that you suggested should have been done sooner? And also, what reaction are you getting to your transition roadmap? How are you doing in getting that across? Thank you.
Yes. Since the announcement of the Syria transition roadmap, we did actually an advocacy trip. We've been in Washington, in Paris, London, Berlin, Moscow, Ankara, Doha, all the capitals who played a role in the Syrian crisis to educate them about the Syria transition roadmap, and we request for their support. We got actually a very good response by supporting, and many ministers of foreign affairs, they actually they blaze it publicly. But the difficulty is that there is no Syrian political process right now. What you see right now, only strikes, killings, shooting. There is no political process. The only way to get the political process, as I said, to replace the Assad government to allow this. And this has come to your first question regarding the Western Europe. I mean, the Western Europe will be more effective than the US. Because now in Europe, they have two side effects or consequences of the Syrian crisis. First, some of their nationals, they joined the ISIS to kill Syrians and to kill their, actually. And that's really important for the Western Union to get involved and to prevent all the foreign fighters to go to join the ISIS in Syria or in Iraq. The second issue, of course, the number of the Syrian refugees. Sweden itself, they have right now more than 90,000 Syrian refugees, and they accept all of them, and they host them, and they give them actually the second country, of course, Germany, UK, and France less regarding hosting Syrian refugees. The US, we work now with the Congress actually to pass at least a resolution to allow for the US to host more Syrian refugees. This is why it's important for the US to work with Western powers and with the regional powers to coordinate actions, because the Syrian crisis is beyond the capacity of any nations. And that's more important to understand. The US itself cannot handle Syria crisis alone because it has too much complicated and too much issues to be dealt, like not only the issues of the ISIS, you have the issues of the refugees. Then you have to play a constructive role in building the reconstruction of the country again. Then you have the displaced people. Then you have the issue of education. Now we have 3 years kids without schools. We have 3 years of lost generation. The New York Times actually make an appeal last year with the UN for, they call this campaign Lost Generation, because you have kids in the refugee camps, they don't go to schools. They lost 2 years in their lives. This is why you have too much issues has to be dealt. And this is beyond the capacity of the US or of any nations. Of course, beyond the capacity of the Syrians themselves. This is why it has to come joint efforts by the international community to help the Syrians in this difficult time.
Dr. Ziadi, my name is Kamala Hussein Scott. I grew up in Damascus between 1976 and 87. My father's family are refugees, Alawite refugees from the Golan Heights. My mom is German, and we welcome you here. My question is, I've lived here in the United States for 25 years, and do you have any role, how you help women in your transition roadmap? Because you mentioned children, the lost generation. I don't have much contact with my family anymore in Syria, but when I was growing up there, women had a very high role to get an education. You know, I'm 47 years old. All of my cousins are doctors and pharmacists. Yeah. You know, what's gonna happen? I know that a lot of my children's daughters who were supposed to be doctors, they are getting married when they're 17, 18. So do you have anything implemented in your roadmap to help women also? I know this is, you know, in our culture, you know, women are sometimes the mothers and everything, but I would like to see anything progressive, women, you know, refugees, and having women have a better role in helping the future Syrian government.
Thank you for a question, and glad to see the Syrians reach Alaska. Of course, the women in Syrian history played an important role. Syria, it was the first Arabic country in 1951, granted the women to vote and to participate before Sweden, before many European countries. This is why women in Syria since the 50s and the 40s played an important role. But when since the Ba'ath Party came into power, that's made the situation not only men, for also women. Now we have specific programs on empowering women, because in most of the armed conflict, unfortunately, the new leadership, they see the women as victims. And this is actually the difficult part, because we need the women to play as leaders rather than as victims, to be seen as an important role. This is why you will see most of the big humanitarian organization led by women, by the Syrian women doctors or engineers, and that's an important. And also the State Department, they do have special program to empower women in such a transition. I think should be more done by that. And I think that reflects on how things will open in the political process. Most of the cases of the armed conflict, the women take actually side, take back. But when you have a political transition or political process, this is an window, an opportunity for the women to play a much more constructive and important role.
Thank you. The area and the issues in which you're addressing are so complicated, I'm not dead sure I understood what your 1-2 recommendations would be for changes in American policy. Do you mind stating again what America should change in terms of their current policies?
Yes. First, that the United States should impose the no-fly zone or target the Assad troops and forces, not only the ISIS forces. This is actually the first recommendations. And now today there is an appeal by the Emir of Qatar and the Turkish president for this again. To end the Syrian suffering and the Syrian crisis, you should not only target the ISIS troops, because this is, you send the wrong message to the Syrian people. As I said, you have day in the morning, the Assad Air Force, and in the evening, the U.S. forces, and the people, they get stuck.
Well, those forces are all in eastern Syria, aren't they, where the American action wouldn't be quite so ambiguous as you're suggesting?
No.
I mean, that's all ISIS-controlled, right?
As example, Idlib, with the northeast part of Syria, there is no ISIS, but the U.S., they target. And the Assad government, they have daily strikes there. And this is why the question, and you'll see according to the Turkish government, 130,000 crossed Turkey into the last 3 days, mostly from Idlib, from these areas. This is why when the U.S., if the U.S., which very easy now, to impose the no-fly zone or to target the Assad government, that will give assurance to the Syrian refugees to go back to their homes and towns, because they know they will not target it. We can say 95% of the U.S. strikes are accurate. The number that you see now, only 13 casualties being killed, which relatively, of course, not acceptable. We condemn any casualties to be killed. But when Syrian, they say there is a casualties being killed by the Assad government and by the U.S., it's color the, and I think that's make the political goal and the political mission much more difficult. In the news today, we hear that there is a 72 Syrian fighters decided to join the ISIS rather than actually quit from ISIS, because ISIS, they don't have many Syrian fighters, mostly foreign fighters, Iraqi, Saudi, Yemeni. But the Syrian, they saw that They've been targeted by the U.S. government rather than target the Assad. I mean, you cannot win wars only by airstrikes. You have to win the hearts of the people. And this is actually the message you have to send.
Okay. Could I have another round of applause for Dr. Zide? I'd also like to present you this gift for coming to Anchorage to speak to the World Affairs Council, and we hope to see you back again. Appreciate that. A reminder that Dr. Ziadeh's a Syria transition plan is on CD, and there's a few copies of it on the door, on the table on the way out if you're interested. As Lisa mentioned when we started, the World Affairs Council is a membership-supported institution. If you found today's speaker to be interesting and stimulating, please consider being a member. We have cards at the table where you can join, and this is what allows us to bring programming like this to Alaska. And also like to ask you to please join us next Friday here at the Hilton at noon, where we have Dr. Ronald Tamman, who will be speaking to us on Will China Rule the World? And lastly, if you have one of the name tags that's with the plastic liners on us, please help us by recycling those before you leave today. And thank you again for coming.